The Guardian.
This Guardian podcast is supported by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that gives you the power of beautiful design. So you can do more than create a website, you can set yourself apart. To start your free trial, visit squarespace.com/guardian.
The Guardian Books Podcast with Claire Armistead.
Hello and welcome to the Books Podcast. This week's guest is Pat Barker, who joined us in London for a live event to discuss her new novel, Noonday. Best known for her multi-award-winning novels of the First World War, she explains why she has decided to fast forward to the Second World War for this third volume of what has become known as her Life Class trilogy. She opened with a reading which reintroduces us to her characters in a city under bombardment in the Blitz.
Afterwards, it was the horses she remembered, galloping towards them out of the orange street darkness, their manes and tails on fire. One huge black shire horse with frantically rolling eyes came straight at them. Eleanor wrenched the steering wheel violently to the left, and a few yards further on, pulled into the curb. In the rearview mirror, she saw the horses galloping away, their great, bright, battering hooves striking sparks from the road. She remembered a thud against the side of the ambulance and thought she might have caught one a glancing blow on the shoulder as it careered past. She sat, breathing heavily, looking at her orange hands on the wheel. Even her skin didn't look like skin. Beside her, in the co-driver's seat, Neville cleared his throat. "Would you like me to take over for a bit?" "No, thank you," she said, with another glance in the rear-view mirror, preparing to move off. She might have taken that from Dana or Violet, but certainly not from him. "Actually, Kit, if you want to know what it feels like to have your testicles skewered and roasted over a slow fire while you watch, you could try saying that again."
Now, that is an extraordinarily striking episode, partly because we associate horses with the First World War, don't we?
Yes, the war horse particularly.
Yeah, now.
I think these are brewery horses. You know, if a brewery was bombed at the dray horses and the dray horses caught fire. That is actually a personal memory. You know, it's not out of a book, it's not out of research.
It's a
memory of the London Blitz, yes. The horses with their manes on fire, which has always haunted me.
Yeah. So now that we're back with Eleanor and the rest of the characters from Toby's room, except for Toby,
who's the big glaring absence. Yes, the absent presence.
The absent presence.
As I think an awful lot of young men were, the young men who died, and, you know, there was always the feeling of the empty bedroom, the empty place at the dining room table. I think that absence cast a long shadow over the subsequent generation. I remember, it's an incident in the book actually, but was also a personal memory of somebody I was talking to, that when she was a little girl, she was out playing in the garden, and on this particular day, it was very hot, she came in, she kicked her shoes off, and she went down to the downstairs lavatory, which in that household, for some reason, was for the men. But on this day, she went to that lavatory, and then she came out, and she looked at the photograph of her uncle, who had died in the First World War, and she picked up her shoe and threw it, and she stamped her foot and shouted, "It wasn't my fault." And she was about 5 or 6, and you can imagine what the atmosphere in the house must have been like, actually, that, you know, the sense of oppression, the sense of, you know, a young life being shadowed by what had gone before.
One of the results of this is that you're dealing with people in middle age.
Yes, they think they're terribly old,
of course.
I don't think so.
How old would they be?
Oh, they'd certainly be well into their 40s, I think. The men are above military age anyway. Mm. So if they want to contribute to the war effort, and they do, they have to do it through the emergency services. And Eleanor, quite unlike her initial reaction to the First World War, also decides that she wants to be actively involved and becomes an ambulance driver.
Mm-hmm. And it's not giving away too much to say that she and Paul are married.
They're married, they don't have children. It's not never made quite clear whether this is entirely a matter of choice. But certainly Eleanor, whether it's a choice or not, takes great exception to the feeling you get from some people, including, I'm afraid, women, that a woman who hasn't had children isn't a real woman. And
there's a lovely line from the,
from the gynecologist. When she goes to a gynecologist, because she's at that time of life, and her menstrual cycle has gone haywire, and the gynecologist says to her, steepling his fingertips and twinkling at her, "Of fibroids are the tears of a disappointed womb."
You must have been in a particularly malevolent mood when you made that line up. And there is a misogyny that runs through this. And one of the, you have quite a lot of historical figures in the novels, and one of them here is Kenneth Clark, who is a terrible old fogey, isn't he?
Well, I mean, he's very patronising to the women artists. He thinks there is a female view of war, and that is what the woman artist is supposed to represent. And it's a subject of considerable debate, or has been in the past, whether there is a specifically feminine type of literature or art or whatever. And I'm not absolutely certain that I think there is. Eleanor doesn't think there is. But then, having decided that, she doesn't believe women are more compassionate than men, she doesn't believe they're less tough than men, and she thinks a woman artist is expressing her individual point of view exactly as a male artist is. But having decided all that and got it clear in her mind, when she does a particular painting about a dead child being pulled out of a destroyed building, and it is actually childbirth. It's quite clearly the way it's described, the way the fireman rotates the child's head and one shoulder, then the other shoulder comes out. She is actually unconsciously describing childbirth.
But she's told not to deal with any sort of action.
Well, she's told not to
do the children and women in the countryside.
Yes, yes. I mean, but this was a very important part of the government's strategy, that there was the difficulty of maintaining the morale of the fighting men when their wives and children were in danger at home. So it was a great drive to get children evacuated, both for the children's sake, but also for the sake of the morale of the armed forces. But of course, the families couldn't bear the separation. So by September 1939, an awful lot of those children had come back. And Eleanor is told that, children are to be, it's a very suitable subject for you as a woman artist, but they must be safe in the country. They must not be shown being bombed. And, she can't not paint what she sees.
And you have one of those child evacuees in the novel who plays a very important part, funny little boy.
Yes, a funny little boy.
Not a very attractive little boy.
No, quite a little off. Terror, really. He is the age where children were snapped up because it was all a bit of a market when the evacuated children arrived. And big girls were very popular because they could help in the house, and big boys were very popular because they could help on the farm. So it's not clear why this particular child is being shunned until Eleanor walks right up to him and realises that his head is absolutely lousy. It's so lousy that the head lice have started to take short cuts across his forehead. And he has lost his luggage label. He's got his gas mask, but he's lost his luggage label. And she thinks, you did that deliberately. He managed to get himself, for whatever reason, separated from his school. But Kenny is he's a resourceful child, and his whole drive is to get back to his mother, because his mother is claustrophobic, and when the Blitz starts in earnest on Saturday, September the 7th, he He just wants to get back to his mother because she's claustrophobic and he knows she will not go into the shed in the garden. So he's terrified and he runs away, and Paul Tarrant, whom some of you will remember from earlier books, decides that he will take him back and try to reunite him with his mother.
There's a really sad story there, which is that the mother doesn't really want him.
No, she doesn't really want him. And she's just been bombed out of her house. But she's remarried, she has two more children, and Kenny doesn't really fit in. She doesn't really want him. And Kenny makes sure that she will accept him by accusing Paul of molesting him, which is very resourceful.
So you quite like that?
No,
him, do you?
I do. I quite like the sheer bloody-mindedness of this child who is determined to get what he wants. And he's so powerless. You cannot blame a child who is so powerless for bending the rules a bit in order to secure the future they want.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that Eleanor says is we drop the catch, our generation. So there's a sense of the old, you've got Kenny representing this sort of vibrant, younger, surviving generation, and then you've got this older generation who are sort of gently consumed by guilt for what's happened in the last...
Yes, I think they probably were at that stage, because, in 1917, 1918, there was a very strong, powerful sense that people were fighting the war to end war, and that nothing short of that could possibly justify the extent of the slaughter, which went on and on and on. And yet, 23 years later, there they are, and their sons and daughters and nieces and nephews are having to go through exactly the same thing. And I think they felt that they had in some way fallen short and failed, which is, of course, not the way we think of that generation at all. I mean, I think we tend to admire them, what they went through, but they didn't by themselves, I don't think.
Mm-hmm. And Kit, as we know from the previous novel, is dealing with a sort of massively reconstructed face, but it doesn't, he's sort of living a normal life with this face.
He is, yes, he's had massive amounts of surgery. People who had these shrapnel injuries to the face sometimes went through as many as 30 operations and were in hospital quite a long time after the war had ended. It didn't end for them. But, the results were surprisingly good, and Kit is now living a normal life. He's married and he's had a daughter, and he's, until the outbreak of the war, he's living in America.
But you don't mention this facial history. I just thought that's so interesting.
Well, I think people have got, he's got used to it, people have got used to it. What is mentioned is that it affects his breathing and it affects his voice. And that is, as a plot, importance. So it's underlined very, very early on.
Now, there is one character who completely startled me when she arrived, and it's Bertha, who is a medium. And one reason why it startled me is because I thought that it felt like you'd summoned the spirit of Alison from Hilary Mantel's Beyond Black, this sort of fat...
Well, that is because...
medium.
Hilary Mantel and I are both using the same real-life person, Helen Duncan, who, if you Google her, if you Google Helen Duncan, you might find out that she was the last woman to be tried for witchcraft under the witchcraft law of James the First in this country. And even that isn't true, because another woman was tried as a witch 18 months after her, and also convicted.
But it was revealed that it had been fake. But what was the particular thing she was convicted for? She'd said that she foresaw the sinking.
She was convicted of witchcraft. Later than she appears in the book, 1944, she was convicted of witchcraft. And it seems so astonishing. And you think, well, why didn't they charge her with fraud? Because, a lot of what she did was certainly fraudulent. Or why didn't they charge her with treason? Because, the historical Helen Duncan is quite an interesting story. She was giving a seance in Portsmouth, and a sailor appeared, and the sailor was wearing the cap of HMS Balaam, was it? Balaam, I think it was, which had sunk. And I think 800 men had been drowned. But the important thing is, nobody knew it had gone down. The Admiralty had not revealed it. It was a state secret. And yet there it was, revealed in the seance. And I think from that point on, the authorities were quite frightened of Helen Duncan. Because, of course, the great secret at the time was which beaches is the invasion going to land on? And if she's capable of revealing one state secret, God knows how, what else can she reveal? So they wanted her in prison, and they got her there.
And one sort of fascinating thing about her is that you almost get the feeling that you don't quite discount her as a fraud, that she does have something.
I think she does have something, yes. I think she's extraordinarily observant, and she is just a very, very powerful and partially malignant figure. There's at one point, Paul goes to a seance, and he's wanting a cigarette, so he goes downstairs, and he blunders through a door, thinking he's going to be out in the yard. And there is Bertha Mason sitting on a table, stark naked, all 20 stone of her, with a fag end glued to her bottom lip, completely glazed eyes because she's gone into a trance. And in spite of himself, he finds it a compelling image, because there she sits, is sort of a corpulent Persephone claiming to speak for millions of the dead. And somehow, even though you know she's a fraud, and that some of the people who appear are quite obviously papier-mâché heads on broomsticks, still there is that power about her. She's not one thing or the other. And you also have the psychologically interesting thing that although the head to one person is obviously papier-mâché, another person has burst into tears because she's just seen her lost son restored to her.
Now, this relates to your own life, doesn't it, the idea
of
mediums?
My family were very heavily into being mediums. And my grandfather, whom I never knew, he died before I was born, was a medium. And I feel I've got a sort of inside track in the sense that I know that my family were not consciously fraudulent. I believe they believed they were doing what they said they were doing. I don't think, obviously they didn't go in for papier-mâché heads. It was a simply matter of receiving messages. And of course, if you live in a small community, the knowledge you build up over the years of everybody's business is quite astonishing. And it's quite easy, I think, to kid yourself about where the information comes from. My cousin, I've used this in the book, my cousin went to a seance quite recently with her auntie, and her auntie got a message from her dead sister, my cousin's mother, saying, "Why did you take the ring from my finger while I was lying in the coffin?" And the auntie said to my cousin, "You must have told her that. There's no way she could have known what I did if you hadn't told her." And my cousin said, "How could I tell her? I didn't know you'd done that." So, it's a mystery again. But, the obvious explanation, as Paul points out, is that she was in a pub flashing this ring around, and more than one person would have recognised her.
So, one level on which you could interpret the whole medium thing is that this is a novel full of ghosts.
It certainly is that. Paul can't stay in during the raids. He couldn't when he was in the trenches. He couldn't stay in the dugout. He was always walking around from sentry post to sentry post. And he does the same thing in the Blitz. He walks most of the night sometimes. And he has a great sense of the dead gurgling up through the drains. And he looks at a group of very rowdy soldiers, and he thinks they could be soldiers at home on leave who've been through Dunkirk. Or they could be stragglers from Boudicca's army. Who knows? Because from the point of view of the poor bloody infantry, one cock-up is very much like another.
Yeah. And that relates to the depiction of war. And one thing that is very striking in this is that whereas they're in the First World War, they're creative, they're all blocked in this novel, aren't they? I mean, you do have Eleanor finally managing to draw the dead child, but their careers are sort of on hold.
Yes, I mean, and Paul is quite good with the Battle of Britain. He's never been very good at painting urban landscapes. And, of course, the Blitz is a destroyed urban landscape, but an urban landscape nevertheless. And Kit Neville, his reputation has declined. He hasn't been invited to be a war artist. And he and Paul share the common dilemma that their greatest work, or at least their best known and best regarded work, was about the First World War. And that is what is hanging on the walls of the Tate. But their contemporary work, especially Kit Neville's, is less highly regarded. And as Kit Neville says, you know, we should have got ourselves killed. They'd have been all over us then. It's the contrast between Wilfred Owen and Siegfried Sassoon.
And it's I wondered that the extent to which that sort of creative block was to do with London and to do with how difficult it is to summon up London under siege in this way.
Yeah, I mean, the subject is almost too big. And I mean, I felt that too, especially the passage I just read was on December the 29th, 1940, the second great fire of London, the worst of the raids, at least up to that date. And it was incredibly difficult to describe that without dwarfing the experiences of the individual characters. And you can't afford to dwarf them because you're writing a novel, you're not writing history. So the way I tried to deal with that dilemma was to focus on the details, the horses, and that there's another part where Paul looks out of an ambulance window and sees a pigeon walking round and round in circles in the gutter with its wings on fire. And Kit Neville notices that he thinks this doesn't smell like war, because on that night, normally what you've got was a horrible smell of cordite hanging over everything, but on that night it smelled like incense. And that was because in the city of London, so many old churches were burning and seasoned wood produced this very, very characteristic and strange smell.
How did you research it? Did you find it more difficult to research than the First World War? Or was it easier because there's a sort of bigger written record and it happened here?
I think about the same, really. I started off at a tangent. I knew I didn't want to write about the generation, Eleanor's nephew's generation, the generation that's fighting the war. I was particularly interested in the people who were left over from the First World War and the way in which it all impacted on them. So it's starting from that slight angle, everything starts to look different.
There's something in the novel that sort of is hovering underneath the surface all the time, and Paul refers to it a couple of times, which is a sense of relief at the devastation. So when, you know, the awful things happen, and is there a sense in which you feel that a generation were being, you know, that this the guilt or the memory of the First World War was being expunged by the sort of brutality, burnt out by the Blitz?
I think there are always people in war who sometimes behave very heroically, whose private lives are a total mess, and who find the cataclysm of public disaster a relief. In the Durham Light Infantry Museum, there is one of the Durham Light Infantry Victoria Crosses, and he's quite an interesting character, because you look at him, one of the things you notice about him is he's wearing makeup. He's in the uniform, but he is definitely wearing makeup. Very good-looking man. And he saved over 20 people. He was continuously under heavy fire, bringing in the wounded. There's no doubt if ever a Victoria Cross was earned, that man earned it. Then it all became very embarrassing, because he'd enlisted in the army under a false name. And of course, immediately he has to go and see the king and have this pinned on him. His photograph is in the papers. And whatever he was running away from, suddenly he's not running away from it anymore. He must have, cursed the moment when he got the Victoria Cross.
I want to bring you back to women, because your attitude to women in this is quite ambivalent, isn't it, in a way. You've got Kenny's mother. You've got Eleanor's mother. But you've also got Eleanor is not... The sort of cliché is that women were liberated by war, but Eleanor isn't liberated by it, really.
No, and I don't think she was liberated by the first one. Certainly after the First World War, things did get back to normal really rather rapidly. No, Eleanor is... She's not liberated by the war, though she is having experiences which will feed her as an artist when she's had time to digest them. She's certainly living a very different life from what, there's always this thing with women that, there's a sort of official version of the way things are. I remember in the 50s, the official version was that women were happy homemakers, all that nonsense about working in factories, and there you were, polishing your kitchen floor for the 50th time that day, in a state of euphoria. The women I knew were nothing like that. And they certainly weren't stay-at-home housewives because they couldn't afford to be. All the women I knew worked.
To what extent do you think that she's at the centre of the novel? I mean, it's been said of your novels that you choose masculine subjects. War is a masculine theatre.
If you want to write about war, especially the First World War, it would be, I think, very odd to do it from a female perspective, because the demand to take ethical decisions, difficult ethical decisions, applied to men much more than it did to women. I've had a very strange career in a sense, because my first three books, certainly, the commonest question was, why don't you write about men? Because, Union Street, Blow Your House Down, and the Centuries, and Liza's England are overwhelmingly about women. Then at a later stage, I'm now asked, why don't you write about women?
But you've sort of equalised them in this.
I think it is equalising. Eleanor is, she's a feature all the way through the trilogy. I think you could say that she is more dominant in this one than she was in the previous two, though she was important in the last two books as well. And at the moment, the book I'm working on at the moment has got a female essential character telling the story in the first person. So, perhaps I'm balancing it out over time.
Are you moving out of the wars for this next one?
I'm writing a book which is a sort of commentary, a fictional commentary on the Iliad. It's not historical because, of course, the Trojan War is almost certainly not historical. Certainly not in the form Homer describes it. What I'm doing is that the first chapter of the Iliad, Agamemnon and Achilles quarrel over a slave girl, and Agamemnon has to surrender his slave girl, and he's so cheesed off about it that he goes and takes Achilles' slave girl, who has been awarded to him for exceptional valor, and takes her for himself. So it's two powerful men quarrelling over two very young, beautiful, fertile girls. And the men make these stupendous speeches, roaring at each other in the public assembly. And the girls say absolutely nothing. And what I'm writing at the moment is called The Silence of the Girls. And the girls speak up.
You've just come to the end of another trilogy, so you've written two huge, great trilogies,
which have taken
you a long time. Are you going to do another one? Is this the start of your Trojan trilogy?
For the same reason, I'm not going to get a dog. I'm too old. I'm too old to see it out. So I think I'm allowed a fairly modestly sized standalone novel next.
Did you start both of these knowing that they were both going to be trilogies?
I didn't know the Regeneration trilogy was a trilogy. In fact, I spent ages trying to write the last chapter of regeneration in such a way that Rivers and Sassoon and Pryor and Owen would all reach a neat conclusion. And of course they can't, because, you know, Sassoon still doesn't believe in the war. He's going back to it. Rivers' faith in what he's doing has been shaken. Owen is going off to die, and, you know, Billy Pryor is Billy Pryor. So, no, I couldn't bring it to a conclusion. There wasn't a conclusion, except for them to get out of the war, at the end of the war. So at that point, it became three books. It was never two books. It was first one, then three. And this one, well, I read in the newspapers after I wrote Life Class that it was a trilogy, and I always believe what I read in the newspapers.
Now, you must be teasing.
Oh, no, no, no. I think it was in the Sunday Times, I'm not sure. I can't possibly blame The Guardian.
So what you're actually saying is this next one might end up being a trilogy.
There isn't enough of the Iliad. I think I'm fairly safe this time. I think it will be quite short. I hope it will be powerful. And I think one of the things that I feel very powerfully is that, you know, people being left out of stories, the story being about somebody else and who gets left out, that interests me. But what interests me too is that there are girls exactly like those girls in Syria today going through exactly the same experiences, and I don't suppose anybody's listening to what they have to say about it either. You know, you think of these things as being in the dim and distant past. Actually, they're not, are they?
Mm. I'm going to ask one more question, and it's about your use of historical figures. And it's interesting that you referred there to as a real historical situation. There's a sense of you always that you put in historical figures as coordinates into your novels. We've got Kenneth Clark here, you had Rivers in Regeneration, you had Tonks, the maxillofacial surgeon,
yes,
in the previous novels.
Yes, and the surgeon was also a real, of course. I mean, I think that Rivers, Sassoon, and Owen are really rather different because they are actually major characters. They are the major characters in Regeneration. And to a certain extent, Rivers goes on being, I think, the major character all the way through that trilogy. Whereas really, Tonks and Gillies, the surgeon, in this trilogy, they're much more minor characters. I always try to be historically accurate if I'm using the name of the character. But there are all kinds of relationships between fictional characters and reality. One is somebody like Rivers, who has to be described accurately. But there's also somebody like Bertha Mason, you see, who is has a lot in common with Helen Duncan. But nevertheless, I feel quite free to change things about her because she isn't actually there under her own name.
So you wouldn't necessarily need to know that Bertha exists, whereas it is relevant that there was a surgeon called Tonks.
Yes, I think so. I think the rules are quite different. I think if you're using somebody's real name and they are a real person, it's almost more like a historian than a novelist. You've got to bring them to life as a fictional character, but I do think you have to be as accurate as you possibly can be and not misrepresent them, not say they believe things that they didn't in fact believe.
But nevertheless, you have to keep faith with the idea of Bertha, the idea of where she came from.
Bertha and Helen Duncan.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, Helen Duncan is... I think my Bertha is probably more intelligent and probably more complex and less of a total fraud than her real-life equivalent, simply because if she's not simply a total fraud and nothing else, she becomes a much more interesting character.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.